alert the candlelit constabulary, you banjaxed Flahertys. Welcome to the Blind Boy Podcast. If this is your first time, consider going back to an earlier episode to familiarise yourself with the lore of this podcast. I had a little moment of synchronicity this week. Now, when I say synchronicity, I don't refer to something that's supernatural, but rather a little coincidence that I take personal meaning from. I was eating a digestive biscuit. I don't often eat digestive biscuits. I don't seek them out. I don't buy them. But if I come across a digestive biscuit, I will most definitely partake in it. It's a very simple, inoffensive biscuit. There's a satisfying snap when you bite down on a digestive biscuit. Not too much resistance, like a rich tea, but not so crumbly that it's a shortcake. It's the perfect balance between hard and crumbly. Digestives also, they're not very sweet. They're not as sweet as other biscuits. You wouldn't class them as a confectionery. A digestive biscuit isn't going to spoil your dinner for being too sweet. There's a rumour of sweetness in there, like the smell of golden syrup. And just when you search for the sweetness, that faint sweetness within a digestive biscuit, you're met with a salty barrier, like a ball cock of salt. Not too salty, but like about as salty as human skin, like when you lick your own arm on a summer's day. That's how salty a digestive biscuit is. So I was in a hotel room. I was in a shit hotel room in Roscommon, because I'm filming a documentary for TV, which I can't get into. But I'm travelling all this month and staying in little weird hotels. The type of hotels that have individually wrapped digestive biscuits beside the little kettle that I'm always afraid to use in case someone pissed in it. But as I was eating this digestive biscuit in the Roscommon Hotel, sitting on the edge of my bed, a single golden itinerant crumb of digestive biscuit landed on the palm of my hand, and I took the index finger of my other hand and I gently pressed down on this crumb and started rolling it around that real tickly sensitive part on the palm of my hand, and it brought back very specific memories of the first time I ever touched a boob. When I was 15, it was about the first summer I ever started drinking alcohol. I'm not encouraging this. It's just what happened when you were 15. When I was growing up, you drank alcohol. This is what you did at the weekends. It was a summer's evening, and there was a group of about 11 or 12 of us, and we'd managed to source bottles of cider, Linden Village cider, 2 litre bottles. Because we were teenagers, we wanted to drink this cider. We wanted to get drunk. We had to go bush drinking. Bush drinking is what we called it at the time. You couldn't openly drink alcohol when you were 15, not in public, because it was irresponsible and it was dangerous. It wasn't safe. You're not supposed to drink alcohol when you're 15. You can end up in hospital. So if an adult saw you drinking alcohol, they'd call the guards, and the guards would come, they'd take your alcohol, and they'd bring you home to your parents. So 11 or 12 of us, teenagers with bottles of cider, we had to find a hidden, secluded area to drink our alcohol. Now, this was difficult in the middle of a city, but we managed to find a very large roundabout, a really big roundabout that had a bunch of trees and brambles and nettles in it. So we all went into this big roundabout, hidden amongst the bushes, and drank our cider. The slanty orange evening sun breaking through the leaves felt like being in Vietnam, and the sound of all the cars whirring around us, because we're in the middle of a fucking roundabout drinking cider, which was unbelievably dangerous now that I think back. But we were 15 and we had to hide it. But I don't think anyone got unbelievably drunk, because there was like 12 of us and 3 2-litre bottles of cider, and we're sharing it. So we would have all gotten a little bit tipsy and then pretended to be a lot more drunk than we actually were. there was a fairly even distribution of boys and girls. Because we were all pretending to be way more drunk than we actually were, someone suggested playing Truth or Dare. Now, we were 15, so we weren't actually going to play Truth or Dare. No one wanted a truth. No one was asking for a truth. You went immediately for Dare. We knew what Dare meant. It meant shifting. It meant kissing with tongues. And someone would say, usually it was the girls. The girls would say, I dare you to shift her. Or I dare you to shift him. And the girls doing it, they had an idea of who fancied who. It was a way to pair people off into couples when we were all a little bit too shy to ask each other ourselves. A year previously, we'd been at teenage discos where boys and girls are at opposite sides of the fucking dance floor, and then maybe a slow dance at the end, and then literal actual fucking nuns coming in and separating you with a sweeping brush. So we've all done our truth or dare. Dare, will you shift her? Yes, I will. And eventually we're all paired off into couples and we find our individual spaces within the roundabout, which meant being slightly tipsy, lying down on nettles with the smell of rat's piss and yellowed Lucozade bottles and crisp packets, lying down on a bed of sun-bleached, discontinued confectionery wrappers. I'm talking the wrappers of Marathon bars. That's what they used to call Snickers in the fucking 1980s. I've seen those wrappers in these roundabouts when I was a teenager. So I'd been paired off with a girl. Let's call her Evelyn. Her name wasn't Evelyn, but she was my friend and we fancied each other. So we'd been paired off to shift each other on the ground in a hedge as cars whirled all around us on the roundabout. Shifting meant kissing with tongues. So I start shifting Evelyn and we're both enjoying it. Then after a while, Evelyn gets my hand and puts it up her top. I'd have been much too nervous to be doing that myself, but Evelyn did that, and then my hand is up her top and I'm feeling a boob for the first time. Now, I'd been thinking about boobs for a good 3 years, I'd say, and this was the first time, and it was fantastic, even though my hand was constricted by the wire of a bra and it wasn't very comfortable at all. I couldn't believe it. There's a boob in my hand. For 3 years I've been like, these things are amazing. I wonder what they feel like. Now I know I'm feeling one. This is magnificent. I didn't care that there was really, really loud cars whirring around me 10 feet from my head. I didn't care that I was lying on nettles. I didn't care that I could smell rat's piss. I didn't care that a Marathon wrapper was crinkling under my left thigh. I was touching a boob of a girl I fancied. I was so focused on the boob that I stopped moving my tongue, I think, which must have been awful. But then I started to notice after a while, as I was feeling Evelyn's boob, there was something extra there. There was something extra up her bra. It was the tiny crumb of a digestive biscuit, a little sharp thing digging into my palm. I knew it was a digestive biscuit because I was familiar with that unique crumble. Now my thoughts are drifting off, thinking about how it got down there. Was Evelyn eating digestive biscuits beforehand? Maybe she was. Maybe it went down her top. This was hugely distracting. This was my first boob. I was marvelling at the softness of a boob. And then you have this completely jarring, conflicting texture in one central spot in the middle of all this. Now, it didn't mar the experience. It was fucking fantastic. I loved it. But an uninvited third party was present in the form of a fucking digestive biscuit crumb up Evelyn's bra. I didn't say anything. The shift ended. And then for weeks and weeks and weeks, because I'm 15 and I'm horny all the time, I'm just thinking about, my God, I can't believe I touched a boob. I can't believe that. And I keep trying to remember what it felt like. But every time I remember what it felt like, I can't disassociate the digestive biscuit crumb. The sensory memory of the digestive biscuit crumb in the palm of my hand is forever there when I think about touching a boob. So I'm so excited. I'm thinking about this all the time, replaying the memory in my head, wanting to do it again. But as the days pass, I start introducing little digestive biscuit crumbs into my palm deliberately and playing with them with my finger in my palm, like at home, in the classroom, not as a sexual thing. I wasn't fetishizing it, but an event of great excitement had occurred in the palm of my hand. I was thinking about it all the time. This crumb business in my palm was a sensory thing that I enjoyed for weeks afterwards. Sometimes even into adulthood, when I'd feel boobs, there'd be a little phantom biscuit crumb there in my hand as an indelible sensory memory. Not like here you'd never crumble a few biscuits into your bra, not a digestive biscuit fetish, but a single crumb of a digestive biscuit and a boob or two boobs, these things are inseparable for me. But as the weeks went past, after I'd touched Evelyn's boob, extreme guilt popped up. I started to experience extreme guilt and shame. And this guilt and shame manifested itself as anxiety. I was 15, so I started to worry. Fuck, what if I got her pregnant? Or what if I have AIDS? I'd been raised with Catholicism since I was 4 years old. Catholicism, the Catholic religion, was a part of my education every single day in school. And my sex education was given to me by a fucking priest when I was like 13. And they basically brought the priest into school for a day. And the priest's job was to scare the living fuck out of you. The priest told us specifically, avoid heavy kissing. Heavy kissing leads to sex. Sex is a sin. Not only is sex a sin, but you'll get HIV if you have sex. We were explicitly told that sexual diseases or venereal diseases, these things exist as a punishment for the sin of sexual contact before marriage. We were told that if we had a wet dream, it meant we slept with the devil. We were told not to masturbate. And we were told that if you got an erection and you felt like masturbating, that you were supposed to think of a polar bear floating on an iceberg. And if you think of that, you'll lose your boner. So I got extreme guilt. I got extremely guilty and terrified because I touched a boob. I understand it's utterly ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous to think that I might have gotten a girl pregnant by touching her bare boob. It's equally as ridiculous to think that I might have gotten HIV or AIDS by touching a boob. But I was 15. I didn't have the emotional intelligence or the sexual education to process the complexity of the guilt that I was feeling. So that guilt immediately transformed into very, very irrational anxiety. I started to punish myself. And that punishment was, you've got a disease now, you're going to die. And the digestive biscuit, that little crumb of digestive biscuit, became the fucking proof. I became convinced that the little bit of digestive biscuit was actually Christ. Now that's insane. I know it's insane, but try and explain that to a 15-year-old in the middle of a panic attack. Now how did I start to think that this digestive biscuit was Christ? Fucking communion wafers. You have to realise, when we were like 7 or 8, a full fucking year of our education, a full year of our education, and this is the 90s, I'm like 7 or 8, a full year of our education was, you're going to make your first Holy Communion, you're going to make your first Holy Communion. And every week, as a 7-year-old child, zero capacity for critical thinking, your teacher would prepare you for first Holy Communion every week in accordance with Catholicism. And we were told as kids, the whole point of communion is that this here is a piece of bread, this is the host, this little wafer here is the host. But once that priest blesses it, it stops being a piece of bread and it becomes the body of Christ. And even at 7, we all asked the question, how can that be the case, teacher? It's bread. It's a wafer, I can see it. And then the teacher goes, no, once it's blessed, it becomes Christ. But it's bread, teacher, we can see it. No, it isn't. This is the miracle of transubstantiation. Once the priest blesses it, it becomes Christ, literal. It's a man, and the wine is his blood. And you're effectively gaslit. You're gaslit as children to believe that the communion wafer is not a wafer, but is an actual man's flesh. And if you don't believe that and you don't accept that, then it's a sin and you're not ready for it. So when I was feeling my first bob at 15 and I experienced the intense Catholic guilt of I'm doing a dirty, sinful, wrong thing. And no matter what you do, God is always watching. When that biscuit crumb was there and I was getting anxiety, my irrational thoughts immediately went to, ah, it's Christ. That's what he does. He showed up. He turns into bread. That's what he does. He's bread. He's bread and bread is him. That's what was happening in that bra. Christ showed up to let you know that he's seen you being dirty and sinning. And now you've got a disease or she's pregnant. Now you're fucked, buddy. You're fucked, you are. And I'd spent time at 15 saying to myself, that's fucking ridiculous. Don't be ridiculous. It's just a biscuit. It's just a biscuit. And I'd get nice and calm. And then later on that day, anxiety would kick in. My heart would start racing. And I'd be like, no, it was Christ. Christ showed up in the bra. Christ was there. Of course he did. You touched a boob. You touched a boob. You're not married. You touched a bare boob. That's a sin. You can't say it to anyone. Couldn't say it to my parents. What am I going to say to my parents? I touched a girl's boob last week and there was a crumb inside and I think Christ was present. Can't go to your parents. Can't go to the teachers in school. I considered going to confession. Certainly wasn't going to bring it up with Evelyn. Wasn't going to bring it up with the lads. I'm already getting a reputation for being eccentric or mad. I'm sure neurodivergence is at play here. I'm sure the tisms are involved. So I can't turn to anybody. So I did what I'd always do to deal with anxiety when I was a teenager. I'd isolate myself and disappear into my encyclopedias. There was no internet. Probably better off. There was no internet. I cracked open the encyclopedias. Went learning everything I could about pregnancy. My encyclopedias were world book encyclopedias from 1979. So there was nothing in there about HIV. So I went to the library. I went to the library and started researching. I tried to manage my anxiety by learning everything I possibly could about biscuits. About digestive biscuits in particular. There wasn't a huge amount, but the woman in the library was very helpful. I didn't tell her why I was researching biscuits. But she did give me a book on the history of baking. And I found a section about biscuits. And I learned that biscuits traced their roots to sailors. So this week when I was in my hotel in Roscommon and I'd just eaten a digestive biscuit, I started rolling that little bit of biscuit crumb around in my palm, and it reminded me of that tremendously anxious period of my life, and it inspired me to pick up where I left off with my biscuit research. So biscuits have existed for as long as humans have been baking bread. Biscuits historically were a starvation food. You can go back 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia, the Fertile Crescent. Humans were farming wheat in little villages and towns, and they were grinding up this wheat and baking bread 5,000 years ago. But wheat and bread can spoil. It can go off. It has to be fresh. So bakers, they'd bake a loaf of unleavened bread, so bread that doesn't rise, it doesn't contain any yeast, just flour and water, maybe a bit of oil. They'd bake this loaf of bread, cut it up into slices, and then put those slices back in the oven. They'd bake this until all the moisture was gone, completely gone. And what you're left with are these really, really hard bits of bread. They'd break your teeth if you tried to bite them. And you could store these things for months or years. They'd never go off. And the word biscuit, it comes from the Latin bis coctus, which means twice cooked, twice baked. That's what biscuit means. It's bread that's been cooked twice. So throughout history, it was a way of preserving wheat. Preserving wheat at a time when it wasn't growing, or if people had to travel a long distance, they'd carry around these biscuits, these really hard pieces of wheat that would never go off. And they'd soak these biscuits in a liquid of some description and eat it. What I find interesting is my teenage paranoia about this digestive biscuit presenting in Evelyn's bra as Christ. I was actually onto something. A very early type of biscuit is known as matzah. It's unleavened flour and water baked into a crispy like cracker. And Jewish people eat this in Passover. At the Last Supper, before Jesus' crucifixion, he was eating a Passover meal. He was sharing a Passover meal with all his disciples. That was the Last Supper. So the bread that he held up and said, "This is my body and this is my blood," the first ever fucking communion, that was a biscuit. And as Christianity progressed in the years that followed, and communion being a hugely important part of Christianity, the Catholic Church, as it progressed, started to make communion hosts or communion wafers or whatever you want to call them. By the 800s, 800 years after the birth of Christ, the church in Europe were making communion wafers in these irons, like early types of waffle irons or like a toasted sandwich maker. The church would have these irons that have the imprint of a crucifix in it or whatever. They'd put the dough in and then they'd put it over a fire and a communion wafer would pop out. By the 9th century, communion wafers were so popular and so in demand in like France, for instance, the church would hire loads of bakeries to just keep making us loads of communion wafers. Because you see, at this point, they're just hosts. It's just bread. It doesn't turn into Christ until a priest blesses it. So in France, there was all these bakeries churning out fuck tons of communion wafers, selling them to the church. But then, to make a bit of money on the side, the same bakeries were using the communion wafer irons with bits of sugar or spices or cinnamon or whatever was available in the 9th century and making the first sweet biscuits. But when the age of colonization comes about, I'm talking the 1400s onwards, that's when you see a real explosion of biscuits. Ship's biscuits. Now you have the great nations of Europe, quote unquote, discovering, quote unquote, the likes of America or Asia. I'm talking Britain, France, Portugal, the Dutch. In like 1500, for a ship to get to the Caribbean from Britain, that's like 2 months at sea. How did the sailors feed themselves on those long journeys? Because you can't take fresh food with you for 2 months with no modern refrigeration. They ate biscuits, specifically a type of biscuit called a ship's biscuit. Unleavened bread, flour, water, cooked the arse out of it so that it's rock hard and it never ever goes off. And that's what sailors would eat. And they'd soak these biscuits in hot water or in rum. If they were lucky, they had a bit of dried salted meat. And these hard tack ship's biscuits are what enabled colonization. Otherwise, the sailors would have died on such a long journey. There's ship's biscuits in museums today from the 1830s, and you could still eat them. Biscuits have been away, twice baked, to preserve wheat so that it never goes off. But what I find really interesting with the history of biscuits, it's when the Protestants start to get involved. Like the whole point of Catholicism, the main thing about Catholicism is this communion wafer is actual Christ. That's what we believe in. We're Catholics. When this fucking communion wafer is blessed, when this biscuit is blessed, it turns into a 2,000-year-old carpenter from the Iron Age. A miracle occurs and you have to believe this. This miracle is called transubstantiation. You gotta believe this, and if you believe that, you're a Catholic. Then the mid-1500s, the Protestants come along, and the Protestants say, "Fuck that, you're talking out of your arse. What do you mean, It's a fucking man. What do you mean you're actually eating Christ? You lunatics. Are you cannibals? We protest that. We're Protestants. This isn't the body of Christ. It's just a fucking biscuit, you stupid bastards. It's a symbol. That's all it is. It's a symbol. It's not an actual man. Now that's the difference between Catholics and Protestants right there. That's a gross oversimplification. That's not the only reason that Protestantism came about. Protestants were mainly protesting abuse of power and corruption within the church. But if you had to give the simplest answer possible, Catholics believe that communion wafer is an actual man, and Protestants believe it's just a symbol. It's just a biscuit. But what you see from this in biscuit history, and this is what I find really, really interesting, Protestants become kind of obsessed with biscuits. They become obsessed with baking. Now, before I get into the history of this, something I find fascinating. There's an urban myth in the north of Ireland, okay? Don't know how true it is, but it's an urban myth that in the north of Ireland, you can tell a Protestant because they put their toaster in the cupboard. So Protestant people in the north, for some reason, they put their toasters in the cupboard. They hide their toasters away when they're not being used. Now I've thought about that. If you're a true Protestant and you completely reject that the bread turns into a man when it's blessed, that's going to leave you with a bit of anxiety about toasters. You see, because what does a toaster do? A toaster takes bread and transforms it into toast. It changes the nature of bread into something else. I think that's why Protestants put toasters in the cupboard. Toasters are inherently Catholic because they take bread and transform it into something else. So I think Protestants are just a bit freaked out by it. So they make their toast and then they're like, get it the fuck away, put it in the cupboard. I don't want to think about it. Let's go back to biscuit history. By the 1800s, different Protestants in America and in Europe and in Britain, different Protestants start to really investigate biscuits as a medicinal product. And I find it fascinating. It's as if they're trying to actually do something useful with communions. Like, those crazy Catholics over there think that their bread is actual Christ when it's clearly not. Well, maybe we can get biscuits, the host, maybe we can get biscuits and scientifically make them into something beneficial. So for instance, you've got a fella called Sylvester Graham, right? He was an American Presbyterian minister, so a Protestant minister. He invented a type of biscuit called a Graham cracker. Whole wheat flour and water baked like a biscuit, twice baked. It's a biscuit. They call it a cracker, but the Graham cracker is a biscuit. Sylvester Graham, in the 1800s, the Protestant minister, he invented Graham crackers to stop people wanking. I'm dead serious. He wanted to create an unleavened, pure type of communion wafer, you could call it, even though it wasn't a sacrament. He was chasing this pure, clean bread that when you put it into your system, into your stomach, you won't want to wank anymore. You've also John Harvey Kellogg inventing cornflakes as a way to stop people wanking too. But dead serious, the Graham cracker, which is the American digestive biscuit, was invented to stop people masturbating by Protestants. They're trying to do something useful with communion wafers. The Catholics are promising the sun, moon and stars, you're actually eating God. And the Protestants are going, don't be ridiculous, but we can make you stop wanking. And then you go over to Scotland in the late 1800s. And you've the Protestants making biscuits over there as well. In the Victorian times, people believed that a lot of ills in the body, whether it be mental illness, anxiety, pain, people believed that a lot of this originated in the stomach and what you ate. So a lot of different biscuits were invented by Protestants to improve digestive health. Like you had the Abernathy biscuit, which is a Scottish biscuit from the early 1800s. But this is where the digestive biscuit steps in. A fella called Alexander Grant in Scotland was developing the first digestive biscuits. He was looking for biscuits that stopped people farting. That's what digestive biscuits were invented for, to stop people farting. And the reason they were called digestive biscuits is because they had a little bit of bread soda in them. So it was believed if you ate these biscuits, the bread soda would settle your stomach and then you wouldn't be farting. So you've got graham crackers, which are basically digestives, slightly different in America, to stop people wanking. And then you've got digestive biscuits in Scotland to stop people farting. Wanking and farting both seen as terrible sins by the Protestants, things that need to be eradicated from the body through good digestive health. So that's where digestive biscuits come from the McVitie's company in Scotland. And that's why they're called digestives. They're Protestant communion wafers that stop you committing the sin of farting. I opened this podcast by speaking about a moment of synchronicity for me. So I was in this hotel in Roscommon, eating a digestive biscuit, and then I rolled the little grain of digestive in my palm, and it reminded me of, remember the first boob you ever felt? And then that sent me down a digestive biscuit rabbit hole on the internet for the evening. So there's a definite strange kind of sectarian thread of Protestant versus Catholic theme emerging in the history of biscuits that I'm identifying. Something strange that I've heard that I've never understood the answer to is, so in the 1980s and the 1990s, in the period known as the Troubles in the north of Ireland, the IRA started to develop like homemade rocket launchers, armor-piercing rocket launchers. Colonel Gaddafi in Libya had given the IRA a lot of Semtex, and the IRA were making their own rockets and firing them at British armoured tanks and blowing them up and firing them at British helicopters and taking them down out of the air. And there was even a mortar attack, I believe, on Downing Street in the early 90s. But what the British Army found, whenever the British Army up north, when one of their armoured personnel carriers was blown up, or whenever a helicopter was shot from the sky by one of these homemade rocket launchers, when the British Army would go to where the IRA shot the rocket from, they used to keep finding loads of digestive biscuits. Not like wrappers of digestive biscuits, but like the Cookie Monster. Like the Cookie Monster had literally gone to a packet of digestive biscuits and eaten them really quickly. Every time the IRA fired a rocket, the British soldiers were like, what the fuck are they doing? Did the RA open up a packet of digestive biscuits and eat them like the Cookie Monster every time they fire a rocket? What the fuck is going on here? They were thinking, is this a joke? Is this some type of symbol we don't understand? What's with the fucking digestive biscuits every time you blow up a tank? And for ages they couldn't understand why. So on Monday, this Monday, March the 18th, a woman died by the name of Rose Dugdale. Rose Dugdale was a unique character. She was English. She was a Protestant. She was like incredibly posh. I mean proper posh English, landed gentry. Her dad was an underwriter for Lloyds Bank, lived on a great estate. Proper English posh. She was a debutante. But Rose Dugdale hated that she came from a posh English family, and she hated colonialism, and she hated capitalism. And when she was like 20, she became like a radical left revolutionary. Rose Dugdale, when she got her inheritance, which was a lot of money, like a quarter of a million quid in the 70s, she literally just gave it all away to the poor people of North London and became a left-wing revolutionary. Eventually, she goes over to the north of Ireland and joins the IRA. This really posh English Protestant from landed money joins the IRA, and I mean heavily involved. Like literally, she joined an active service unit, hijacked a helicopter, flew the helicopter over RUC stations, and dropped homemade bombs made out of milk churns on the RUC stations in a helicopter she robbed. So if the IRA were thinking this posh English one might be a double agent or MI5, it's like, no, she's after robbing a helicopter and now she's dropping bombs on RUC stations, like the first ever bombs dropped on British forces since World War II. Then in 1974, she was part of an IRA raid where they stole a load of Vermeer paintings, a load of really, really expensive paintings from Rossborough House in Wicklow to raise money for the IRA. So this was an incredibly politically radical, serious person. And she died the other day in her 80s. And some of the obituaries are weird. They're a bit misogynistic. They still treat her as the eccentric daughter of a millionaire or someone who was troublesome, instead of going like whether you agree with her tactics or not, instead of going, no, this is a serious radical person who made very strong political decisions and stuck with them until her death. Again, I'm not condoning the Provisional IRA or anything like that. I'm just saying this person was serious. She's more than just a troubled teen who was trying to piss off her millionaire dad. So Rose Dugdale was imprisoned for being a member of the IRA and for stealing the Vermeer paintings from Wicklow. She did about 9 years in prison. And then when she came out of prison, she became like an expert IRA bomb maker. She became part of the IRA team that designs bombs and weapons for the IRA. Rose Dugdale built and designed the IRA's homemade rocket launcher. These rockets that they were making out of Colonel Gaddafi's Semtex. Rose Dugdale designed these homemade rocket launchers. Now think of it. Think of a rocket launcher. It's a thing you put up on your shoulder. A disposable thing. The rocket comes out the front and then there's recoil at the back. So what the IRA found when they were making these prototype homemade rocket launchers is the recoil at the back was too much. The rocket would fire out the front, but then at the back, there was too much of a kickback from the shock and they couldn't get accuracy when they were firing the rockets. So Rose Dugdale tried many different methods, but she eventually figured out if you put a packet of digestive biscuits at the back of the rocket launcher, it will absorb the shock and allow the rocket to be fired accurately. So all the IRA rocket launchers in the 80s and the 90s that Rose Dugdale designed, they shot a rocket out the front, but then spat digestive biscuits out the back, like the Cookie Monster had just eaten them. So this rich, aristocratic, English Protestant is the reason why British soldiers would find chewed up digestive biscuits anytime the IRA launched a rocket. And I learned that the other day when I just saw Rose Dugdale had died. I'd never heard of her. I went researching her while taking a break from my pre-existing digestive biscuit research. I end up researching fucking Rose Dugdale and there it is. She put fucking digestives in rocket launchers. What a bizarre coincidence. What a strange bit of synchronicity. So let's have a little pause now. I'm in my office, as you can tell by the superior warm sound that I have in here. I don't have an ocarina, but I do have a delicious bottle of lemon Turkish aftershave, which I'm going to spray, and you're going to hear an advert for something. Here we go. Lemony.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Too much lemon, to be honest, now I'm after getting it on the mic. That's very powerful Turkish lemon. If you could smell that, you'd get tears in your eyes. It's in my mouth now. I'm inundated with the stench of lemon, that's too much. Support for this podcast comes from you, the listener, via the Patreon page, patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. This podcast is my full-time job. This, after fucking my shit up with this lemon, man. This podcast is my full-time job. This is how I earn a living. It's how I rent out my office. It's how I pay my bills. It's how I exist as an artist. It's why there's a podcast each week, so that I have the time and space, the research, and to fail, because failure is the most important part of the creative process. So if you enjoy this podcast that I make, if it brings you mirth, merriment, fascination, enjoyment, whatever the fuck it brings you, please consider paying me for the work that I'm doing. All I'm looking for is the price of a pint or a cup of coffee. Once a month, that's it. If you can't afford that, don't worry about it. You can listen for free. Because the person who is paying for you to listen for free. So everybody gets a podcast and I get to earn a living. Patreon.com/theblindbypodcast. And also, if you do go to my Patreon, there's an option there to sign up for free that Patreon have introduced recently. Please don't bother doing that. If you're signing up to my Patreon, please only do it if you intend to pay actual money. The signing up for free thing, it doesn't benefit me in any way. I think it just allows Patreon to get your data. There's no benefit to me at all to sign up for free. And also, I don't even post on Patreon. I don't put anything on there. It's just a platform for you to financially support the podcast. The reason I don't put anything on Patreon is that I want everybody to get the exact same experience whether they pay or not. I'd rather not have exclusive content that's only available to people who pay. Also, Patreon, it means I'm not beholden to advertisers. Anyone who advertises on this podcast has to do so on my terms, and I can turn advertisers down. The second advertisers can dictate the content of anything. That's when creativity gets destroyed. I want to turn up each week. I want to turn up each week. I want to turn up each week and genuinely make the podcast that I'm passionate about. This week I'm passionate about digestive biscuits on the inside of a bra. Have you any idea how quickly that would be shot down? If I brought that to a TV station, a radio station. Even the simple plot of this week's episode. I touched a boob when I was 15. And that's why the IRA had digestive biscuits in their rocket launcher. Not a hope. They wouldn't invest in seeing that idea to the end. Do you think fucking McVitie's biscuits would sponsor this? I just give the cunts a free ad. Big long ad for McVitie's. That's what this was. Do you think they'd sponsor this? Guarantee you one of ye's gonna go out and buy a packet of digestive biscuits because of this podcast. McVitie's don't want ye finding out that they were invented as a Protestant fart pill. Fuck McVitie's. Buy off-brand digestive biscuits. Alright, just let's plug a couple of gigs, alright? My big UK tour, my tour of England, Scotland and Wales, right? In April, 21st of April, Newcastle, Tyne Theatre, almost sold out. Glasgow on the 23rd, sold out. Nottingham, almost sold out. Cardiff on the 27th, in the Wales Millennium Centre. I have an unbelievable guest for that Cardiff gig. I don't want to tell you who it is. I have a class guest for that gig. I can't wait to speak to. Come along to that. Brighton on the 28th. Almost sold out. Cambridge is the one place where it's not selling out as fast. Bristol on the 30th. Sold out. And then London, the 1st of May. My biggest ever live podcast that I've ever done. I'm still pinching myself at the fucking Hammersmith Apollo. London on the 1st of May. Come along to that because that's going to be crack. And what have I got? The 18th of June, Vicar Street in Dublin. Nice little Dublin summer gig. Come along to that. Then 7th of July, isn't it? The 18th and 19th of July, I believe. Yes, I'm in the Set Theatre, Kilkenny. Haven't been in Kilkenny in a long time. And then in August, Letterkenny. I know this is ages away, but the promoter is real anxious that I plug this gig. I'm in Letterkenny up in Donegal at Summer Sessions on the 18th of August. I'm an incredibly fatigued man. It's 3 a.m. here where I'm recording this because I was filming all day. I'm filming all this month. I'm making a TV documentary. I can't give you details yet, but I'm very excited about it. I'm making a TV documentary. So if you know TV, TV is very, very, very long hours. Up at 6 in the morning, finished filming at about 8 p.m. at night. So that's me all this month. So I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to sleep for 2 hours. And then I'm going to get up and do some filming. It's not work. It's not work when it's something I'm passionate about. I don't experience it as work. And if I didn't have to sleep, I wouldn't. I would happily go 24 hours a day non-stop if the thing I'm doing is something I'm passionate about. Sleep is something that gets in the way of my passions. So I'll see you next week. Currently in my office, where I am, someone appears to be urinating into houseplants in the corridors, and I think they think it's me because I work such long hours and I'm the only person here at like 3 a.m. So we're going to have to see how that pans out. I'm not urinating into houseplants. I wouldn't do that, especially in a shared space. The only way I'd... Maybe if I had a houseplant that was mine in a private space and it required some nutrients that are only found in human piss, then I'd piss into a houseplant. But outside of that, it doesn't interest me. Alright, I'll catch you next week. In the meantime, rub a dog, wink at a pigeon, tickle a snail.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.